Hi, I'm Kathy Forsty, music director at KC Cafe Radio. It's a great pleasure to spend some time chatting with one of KC Cafe Radio's favorite artists and people, Hillary Scott. Hillary's newest album, Freight Train Love, has already received rave reviews worldwide. Her powerful voice, heartfelt lyrics, and genre-bending song styles makes her one of the best indie artists around today. Hillary, thanks you so much for taking the time to chat with me on KC Cafe Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to talk to you again and hear your voice.
It's been a while since we've seen you in person, I guess, because we weren't able to come to Fringe Fest, which was a bummer because of my stupid head and other issues.
Yeah, well, it was a good show, and we had a lot of pre-sales for your show, but I understand. It was, you can't help that kind of stuff, so.
Right.
Well, I wanted to start off asking you about your name, Hillary Scott. There's another Hillary Scott out there that everybody, well, a lot of people might know from Lady Antebellum. But you're Hillary, you're with one L, she's with two L's.
Right.
Tell everybody how you decided to use the name Hillary Scott for your stage name. I think it's a beautiful story.
Yeah, my brother, Scott, who was an influence on me, obviously. He was 7 years older, and he was a personal influence because I really looked up to him, and he also loved music and played multiple instruments, and I tended to sort of follow him around and wanted to play the instruments that he played, and I did. He played piano, he played violin, and he played saxophone, and I picked all of those up at one time or another. But he actually passed away when he was 29 from complications due to epilepsy. That was right around the time that I was beginning to record and write my own music. And he got to hear me sing, at Christmas and, times like that. But he never got to hear me do my own songs and my own music. And so I took his first name as my last name and used it as my recording and performance name. And even though there's been this complication with another Hillary Scott, who's, got a lot of popularity and notoriety, it's just not something I'm willing to give up. And it definitely does cause, issues. It was nice because with the release of Freight Train Love, we did get Chuck Dauphine from Nashville. He writes for Billboard, and he did address the issue in Billboard, which was nice, and I was hoping that would be one way to sort of streamline it so that I didn't have to, deal with quite as much confusion.
Right. Well, you're better than her anyway, so.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I wanted to talk, too, about your wonderful husband, AJ Gennaro. Mm-hmm. How long have you guys been married, and how did you guys kind of meet and start? Because you work together and you also, cohabitate together. How did that whole thing come together?
Yeah, let's see. We've been married for just over 4 years, and we've been together for just over 6 years. I lived in Columbia for a while, and then I moved back to the Northwest, which is my home state. It's where I'm from, Washington. And then I was doing a recording project with a guy, Wes Wingate, back in Columbia, Missouri. We were doing a duo album called Consonance that we released, and he played with AJ's band. So Wes and AJ played together in a band out of St. Louis, and Wes decided to have us as a duo be the opening act for them on some shows through the Midwest, just to try to kind of help promote the album and get it going. So I met AJ, the first day I arrived back in town to meet the band and start the tour with them. That's when I met AJ. And so we were on the road together for a couple of weeks, and then I was heading off to Vietnam. I was doing a 3-month stint playing solo piano and singing in Ho Chi Minh City. We hit it off so well that we continued to get to know each other over Skype, which, hey, we're still using it. It's still around. And so, we'd have dates, which were actually sitting on our computers and chatting for, hours at a time, even with the time zone differences and everything, and decided that, it was worth waiting to see each other again and see how we did when I was back in the United States. And then we started officially dating, and we got married 2 years to the day after what we considered our first date. So
that's very cool. Do you guys see alike on musical styles, or do you guys ever argue about music? And
it's funny because we don't argue about music per se, and yet we have very different backgrounds in terms of what we listen to, at least in terms of he listened to pretty hardcore punk, things like The Dwarves, and I would never listen to that. But But in other ways, we see things similarly because he's very adaptive and he's played a lot of different styles of music. So, yeah, mostly we agree, but I would say we sort of complement each other. When we do disagree, we usually come out with something that's better, you know, for the arrangement of the song or whatever than it would have been to start with. So.
So how much input does he have in, like, your songs? Like, does he say, hey, that lyric I'm not so sure about, or...
Not really. Any of that kind of... No, he doesn't really get involved in the writing part, but I, you know, as I call it, just arrangement, whenever I bring it to any musician to play along with me, and he's my first, you know, he's my first counterpart, and he's always the one who sort of has first input on arrangement. And I think percussion is so important to the overall sound of a song, and so that's where his input really comes in, sort of the groove and the feel. So yeah
he's a great percussionist. I love watching him play the cajon and yeah, he knows how to use that instrument. Like most people, he gets sounds out of it that I didn't know that people could do. So
it's pretty awesome. And I mean, I love hearing him on the full kit because it has a sound. But yeah, everyone's always impressed by, are you really doing all of that with that little box?
Yeah, exactly. You've got a man inside there or something. So you were talking about that you've performed in Vietnam and all that. How did you get into doing that sort of thing? I mean, did you go straight out of college into performing, or what? How did it all kind of manifest?
Well, that is funny how that came about, because, you know, people have moved completely away from MySpace. And at the time, I remember when people were getting into it, I was a little bit behind the times on that. And people would say, oh, you know, it's just a dating site, or it's this or that. And actually, it was great for making music connections. Mm-hmm. And so I had a MySpace profile, and this woman who runs Premier Talent International actually found me on there, and she is the agent that, you know, sought out the talent for these kinds of overseas gigs. And so it was kind of sudden, you know, she wrote me, and I'm a skeptic about things like that, you know, that something just happens quickly and easily. And so when she first contacted me, I thought, oh, this has got to be a scam. This cannot be real. It's going to be something like where you send in X number of dollars and you know, and I was really, you know, nervous about it. But I decided to go ahead and submit all the materials that she was asking for. And then she submitted them to the venues that wanted these. It was kind of like an artist residency. You're at the same venue for months at a time. And she said, yeah, they want you, and you're going to be leaving. And, you know, I think it was like 3 weeks basically when this first thing happened. Yeah. So it was awesome. It was the perfect time for me to do that. So I spent 2 3-month stints, I guess you'd call them, in Vietnam. I did a 6-month one in Seoul, South Korea, and I also did 4 months in Japan. So it was really neat. It was a really neat time for me.
Yeah, were you playing army bases, or what kind of places were you playing?
No, it was like five and six star hotel, and so you'd go. Oh, wow. And they'd have a venue, yeah, and they'd put you up there, and they'd, you know, I mean, you kind of felt like a rock star in the way that everything was taken care of for you, free room and board, and you know, it was cool. It was lonely sometimes, but it was a really neat experience.
Yeah. So how were the audiences there? Were you like playing mostly covers, or what were you? What were you playing, and what was their reaction to it?
Yeah, I did a lot of covers. I learned a huge amount of material in a short period of time, which was really beneficial for me as a piano player, because I had to do a lot of improv and everything. But also, you could play your original music and sell your CDs there. So I did that. And the audiences were really a mixture of people from all over the world, since they were international hubs and they were huge, like I said, Hyatts and hotels where people were either traveling through on business or they'd be there for a while or whatever. So I met a lot of people from different countries, and the reception was great. I mean, first of all, I have found that everywhere except in the United States, everyone loves American singer-songwriters. I'm joking, but you know, we do sort of ignore in the United States, I think, a good portion of the independent singer-songwriter population, because we just have, you know, commercial radio, and a lot of people aren't tuned into things like KC Cafe Radio or other outlets for independent music. But it's really embraced overseas. So I had nothing but good experiences. And then one of the moments that was really neat was I was in Vietnam, and, you know, I was amazed at just the attitude of the people, the sense of humor, the friendliness, the openness. It was one of my favorite places to be. And I sang, someone requested Imagine by John Lennon, and everybody in this whole room, you know, from many different countries, broke out singing it together. And it was just one of those goosebump moments. And you know, I had several of those while I was there. So it was, you know, it was great.
Yeah, that's awesome. So playing all over the world and being from the Northwest, why did you guys decide to settle in St. Louis and make that your hub?
Well, AJ is originally from St. Louis. And so at the time that I was playing overseas, I kind of felt untethered. I didn't necessarily feel like I really had a home base. I was kind of a free floater at that time. And so... Mm-hmm. It sort of made sense to come here, and he had already purchased a home. He was on top of his game, I guess. So
I had a place to move. He was being an adult.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a place to move into, and that's just, you know, this is also a good central area. It's been really nice for us to tour from here. So
yeah, it's pretty much the middle of the country, and you can kind of go anywhere from there. Yeah. When you were out playing back then, were you playing guitar as well? Or was it just mostly piano kind of things?
It was heavily piano, but a lot of the properties that I was at, they found out that I played other instruments and requested that I bring them along and do like special events. And so like there would be New Year's Eve parties, or there would be private birthday events, or, you know, different things that were sort of extra to my position that I would do. And I did play guitar for some of those as well. So
You also play violin, is that right?
Yep, that's right. And it was like something that I did a lot of when I had the Hillary Scott Band, which was my Columbia-based band, and it was seven pieces. And I had, you know, two other guitarists, and so it was easy to pick up the violin and do these. We did a lot of sort of jam band stuff. I mean, we opened for Little Feet a couple of times because it fit in that thing of getting people up, getting them dancing. The songs would extend for 7-8 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. And since we're traveling as a duo right now, and we're trying to pare down on costs and pare down on what we take along with us so that we can take a small vehicle, I haven't been able to integrate the violin into the song arrangements as much as I want. And so that's something that's actually a goal for this next year, is to try to get that back in. Because I found that people really, they really like it. They really respond to it. So
yeah. And were you classically trained on the violin?
Yeah, I was classically trained on piano and violin and voice. And guitar I just taught myself. So
is it hard to transition from playing classical into playing something more popular? I'm always intrigued by people who are classically trained and then they seem to really excel in pop music as well.
Yeah, you know, it was definitely a struggle when I first started composing, because, and this is like, I'll try to express this as a private instructor of music. I had wonderful, wonderful private music instructors, and I started studying at the collegiate level when I was in seventh grade. But one thing that they didn't focus on, because their interest was 100% classical music, was they didn't really focus on improvisation and composition. Mm-hmm. And so I had all the rules and I had the technique. You know, I had the melodies in my head. Like, I knew things that I wanted to play and I wanted to express, but I didn't have that foundation to look at the piano and see it as a compositional tool. Mm-hmm. And so that was a struggle at first. And that's what I taught myself, was to how to break through those rules and kind of get past what was in my own head and be able to approach it from a different standpoint. However, I do think that, like, my ear for melody, which I consider that to be one of my stronger points, and I do think that a lot of that does come from my classical background, because because so much of the music that I played, as you know, there's a lot of poignant melodies and a lot of counterpoint and harmonization. And that to me is some of the, you know, the most beautiful aspect of music that you can get to. And so then as a private instructor, when I see students who maybe seem to have a desire to create their own music, or just, I just want them to understand the keyboard differently, I try to get them into improvisation and composition a little bit more, because I would have really appreciated that as a student. So
yeah, I was a music major for a while in college, and the reason why I went from being a major to just minoring in music was I was really not enjoying music anymore.
Yeah,
because I was spending so much time, getting into the theory of it all, and you know, you're not really creating your own music. You're deciphering other people's music, and I started writing songs when I was like 13.
Yeah.
So I mean, I was like not enjoying it anymore, and I was spending all this time, deciphering these classical pieces and listening to this, and I just got to where I wasn't enjoying it. So that's why I kind of like, if you got my third year of theory, I was like, I think I'm done with theory.
Well, and it's funny you say that, because I too was thinking of maybe being a double major, English and music, and I switched to English minor at one point as well, because, well, first of all, it was really, really time consuming, because I was trying to do a lot of different things, but also kind of like you said, I think the approach, it's funny, it's almost like you can't enjoy theory until you get to the point where you're not using it as theory, but where it's like, it's, you're using it, and then later on you're going, oh, that's what I did, and you understand it from a theoretical standpoint after you've already done it. Because for me now that I write music, I can explain theory really, really well to students. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel like I ever had anybody explain it to me in a way that made me feel like, how is this useful? How is this interesting? Yeah. How do I apply this?
Yeah, why do I need to know that?
Yeah. And now I feel like I can, and it helps me as a composer. But man, I wish there'd been a different approach in my theory classes and, all that stuff. So yeah, I think a lot of people have the experience that you have when music is brought down to that scholastic piece by piece, tearing it down, breaking it apart thing. And I think that's a shame, because I think there's a way to make it more exciting.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And there has to be a better way to teach it, I think.
Yeah.
And definitely. Still appreciate it. So when you write, do you usually write on the piano, or do you write on the guitar as well? Or does it just depend on the song?
It kind of depends on the song now. But I would say that for the first several years of when I was really getting into writing, it was much more on the guitar. And that goes back to what I mentioned about feeling like with the piano in particular, I was kind of bound by what I'd been studying and the rules and different things. And so the guitar was brand new. I didn't have an instructor on it. I wasn't learning it from a classical standpoint at all. And I was making up chords. I'm sure the chords that I was playing have names now, but I'm just going to put my fingers way up here and, oh, that sounds cool, And so that's what I was doing. And it was exciting to me because I felt absolutely creative. But it's a shift to where now it's about even. I'd say I compose about 50-50 on guitar and violin. So,
and how old were you when you first started writing?
Seriously, writing was probably high school. But that was mostly just music, lyrics and music, college, I would say.
So when you take time to write, do you schedule time to write, or is writing something that just you, whenever you get inspiration, you go do it? Or do you schedule time each day to sit down and try to do something?
I am definitely more of the I don't worry about writer's block and I write when inspiration hits me writer. But at the same time, I've learned from some of my co-writing experiences, a couple of times I've done it in Nashville, and I co-wrote with Michael O'Neill on a couple of songs for Freight Train Love and everything. I found that discipline, but inspiration can come when you invite it in too. And so I think that the discipline side of it and setting time aside is something that I'm going to do more of, because I've usually had pretty good luck with ideas coming when I have a scheduled period of time to do it. So when my life hopefully allows for more of that, I'd like to set aside writing time each day. That would be my goal.
What is your writing process like? Is it more you get a melody in your head and you're like, oh, I got to go sit down and figure something out here? Or do you get like a lyric, or how does it start?
Oftentimes, I almost always lyrics are first, because for me, I think that they're the most important part of a song, which a lot of people disagree with, because, and I mean, if you listen to pop radio, the lyrics often don't matter at all.
Yeah, and they make no sense.
You know, the groove, and it's a melody, and it's this and that. But for me, they're central. I was a prose writer before I was, interested in writing music. So lyrics almost always come first, but sometimes they come together with a melody because, you know, words have rhythm, rhyme, and everything. And oftentimes a melody will just, you know, melodies are pretty easy for me. So they'll often be the second thing. And then from there, it's kind of cohesive. Melody and chord progressions and all that kind of go together. But lyrics usually are first.
Mm-hmm. And so who are some of your favorite songwriters? Who do you kind of admire who did you admire as a kid growing up? And then who do you kind of admire now as well?
Oh, there's so many, but the ones that stick in my head from when I was, and this isn't really from when I was a kid, but, you know, when I was a young kid, you know, as a lot of us listen to what our siblings or our parents listen to, I was lucky because Johnny Cash and Patsy Cline and, you know, some of the classics were in my ears a lot. But then when I had the chance to choose my first CD and then purchase it, I got Peter Gabriel's album So, and he's unusual, and he's I would call him a composer more than just a singer-songwriter, because he's just really, his attention to every bit of production and going and finding percussion from other countries and working with singers from all over the world, and his lyrics, you know, everything about what he does to me was amazing, and it sort of opened up this door to thinking about all the different pieces that make a song interesting and cool and unique. And so he's remained one of my absolute favorites, and a lot of people look at me askance when I say Peter Gabriel, and I go, well, have you listened to anything except Sledgehammer? You know,
yeah.
All you've heard of him is from the radio, then you have not heard Peter Gabriel, you know, so he has a lot of really, really wonderful, amazing stuff.
Even the stuff he did with Genesis was really incredible. Yes. Stuff too.
It was, yeah. I always think of Genesis sort of like the Beatles. I think of him as the Lennon, and I think of
Phil Collins
is the McCartney. Yeah.
Yeah.
Phil Collins had a real pop flair. Mm-hmm. And I think Peter Gabriel was maybe more of a genius.
Right.
A little. Yeah. Not Paul McCartney's not a genius. He's wonderful. But that's just my joke about it.
Yeah. I think you got a point there, actually. So do you remember the first song you ever wrote?
Let's see. No, because I wrote 9 or 10 of them in this big flurry because I was getting ready to record in like a friend's basement, and he had like a good microphone and some things we were going to do. And so I don't know which one came first, but I do know that my first songs were about strife in my young relationships. I do know that for sure.
Yeah, your angst-written songs.
Yes, definitely. I had a few of those for sure.
And you were talking about co-writing earlier. Do you like to co-write? And is it more of like when you're in the recording studio, is that when you co-write, or you like get together with somebody and co-write? How do you usually co-write with someone?
So far, all of my co-writing sessions have been on the basis of some other project going on. So the first time that I did it, Matthew Wilder, who is a producer in Nashville, he was starting sort of a publishing thing, and he hired me, and I got paid for it. Yay! Like a publishing deal. And I went down and I co-wrote with him, and I also co-wrote with John Goodwin and Angela Cassett. And John Goodwin co-wrote some of the music for Crazy Heart, that movie. And so he was really, you know, he was kind of a larger-than-life, cool personality, and we came up with some neat stuff. Those songs haven't all been released yet. They're so different from, I recorded them and I sang on them and, you know, all that, but they're so different from what I normally do that we're kind of trying to decide how we want to get those out there. And then with Michael O'Neill, it was an idea born of the fact that he's a songwriter and he was going to help produce the record and was going to, you know, be the one. He introduced me to Johnny Lee Shell, you know, all those musicians that were on the record. So again, that was sort of an idea of like, hey, we're both songwriters. We should also see what comes out of a songwriting session. And we wrote the songs that we did in really short amount of time. I mean, we were together for, I think, 2 or 3 hours over the course of 2 days. And I had come with a couple ideas already for Diamonds and for Freight Train Love, and then a couple little snippets of lyrics and stuff. And we started with those and went from there, but didn't make it alive. That was pretty much like that was just completely born of the two of us just sitting and brainstorming together. That one was no ideas, no prior ideas were brought for that one. So.
And where did you guys record Freight Train Love?
That was in the studio of Johnny Lee Shell in Los Angeles, so in Studio City, and mm-hmm. He records everybody, and He's just so great. And it's just his home studio, basically. And that's how most producers and engineers are doing it now. Rather than having big, expensive locations, they have the expensive equipment, but it's in, you know, it's in a much more modest area where, you know, you wouldn't know that there was a studio in there.
Yeah. And so is there like a big board that he's working on, or is he using like Pro Tools, or
he has a big board and you know, he kind of has the best of the best in terms of microphones and, you know, equipment like that, but it's a fairly small space. He has the control room, and then he had two isolation rooms, one that was big enough to do drums, and then one that he usually did vocals and guitar in, and then the grand piano was just in the main control room with him.
So there's a nice big grand piano in there.
Yeah. And he has all kinds of different guitars, and he even played Cigar Box Mandolin on one of my tunes. He played it on, I believe, Whiskey Bottle Dry. And so he was just real creative, and he has tons of instruments there at his disposal to work with. And Mike Finnegan, who played keys on it, you know, he can come in and bring in the organ, and, you know, so yeah, any sound we wanted was available somehow. So.
And so on Freight Train Love, this is your, which number CD is this?
I think it's 11 or 12.
Wow. See, that's why I couldn't come up with a good number. That's why I was like, I'm going to ask you. That's a lot.
It is a lot. And there's some of them that, you know, from when I was really young and starting, I think, should we sell this anymore? And then I have people say, well, yeah, you know, because you can't really regret where you've been, because that's where you were, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I try not to like overthink or over criticize and just say it is what it is, and if somebody listens to that and they enjoy it and get something out of it, then who am I to say no, I, you know, this can't be out there publicly anymore or something.
Yeah, so. And that's where you were at that time in your life.
I mean, exactly. Yeah.
So I want to ask you about a couple of the songs on Freight Train Love.
Okay.
Tell me about the song Flowers on Mars. What inspired that song?
A dream inspired that song. I woke up, it was about 3 a.m, and I had the chorus going through my head, and I was like, flowers don't grow on Mars. One day the light will burn out of the sun. And I start just kind of going through my head. I was like, I don't even know where these words are coming from or why I'm thinking these things. And I wrote them down and it kept me awake, and I started to write the rest of the song, which happened pretty quickly. And I thought, was this nonsense, or does this actually make perfect sense in some way? And so as the story started to shape itself around the chorus, which is what came first, I thought, yeah, it's disillusionment. It's, you know, things that will never happen, or things that will happen but that seem so distant that they almost don't seem real, like the sun burning out one day, or, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. Where this woman who is telling the story is a little bit cynical, and you know, she didn't find love, but she's making this declaration that she doesn't need to, that she didn't need it. So it's a little bit of a mix of feelings, and I kind of leave it up to the listener to interpret what they want that to mean. So yeah.
That song should be in the movie The Martian.
Oh yeah, that'd be great.
You should have submitted that to them.
I know.
That'd be great. And also, tell me about Freight Train Love. Why did you decide to make that the title track?
That became the title track when we heard the production values on it, when the musicians had recorded the basic tracks, and we were like, oh my goodness, the groove on this is amazing. And we started to add the background vocals and the organ, and we're like, oh yeah, this is it. We just felt like it was the opening track. We also felt like that idea of the freight train, you know, larger than life sort of thing was how this record was for me. I had never done sort of the big budget record, and this was definitely the biggest one I have done. And that idea of, you know, the freight train, something that's still sort of vintage and sort of raw and real, but also like has momentum and is unstoppable, was sort of, you know, it seemed fitting for this record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great song.
Thank you.
All the way around, lyrically and musically as well. And another one of my favorite songs is Whiskey Bottle Dry. Tell us about that song and how you wrote that one.
So we wrote that in Michael O'Neill's RV. So that was actually where we spent. He tours in a big RV, and he said, yeah, come on and sit in here and we'll get some coffee and we'll write. And that was kind of like, didn't make it alive. That was one of those that just came out of circumstances, I think, that he was thinking of at the time. And then Yeah, it was really organic how that came about. But I think the interesting thing about that song is I sort of view it as almost a masculine reaction sometimes to grief. I think we tend to think more of like, oh, that, you know, if someone's talking about sort of drinking their troubles away or whatever, that would be a masculine viewpoint. And instead, I think it's coming from this more vulnerable feminine place. And again, I don't mean any of those things to sound gender biased or anything like that, not meant to offend anybody, but I think that in music we're used to those sort of divisions. And I feel like that one is just is a different twist on that idea and the inability to get something out of your mind, and whether you think of the whiskey as a metaphor or you think of it as a real thing, just an inability to escape whatever pain you're in at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it's a great album, and I've enjoyed listening to it, and I enjoyed playing it on KC Cafe Radio.
Thank you very much.
You've been out a lot on tour for this album and supporting it on tour. What kind of venues are you playing out on tour?
We're playing a lot of different kinds of venues. So sort of what you'd think of as the classic venue, music venues that have the stage and the lights and the sound man. And then we've been doing house concerts, which I would say are probably the preferred way for a lot of independent musicians to travel, because you're guaranteed a few things. Usually you're guaranteed a listening crowd, and it doesn't matter if that's, you know, 5 people or 50 people or whatever it happens to be. It's really nice to feel like people are specifically there to hear what you put your heart and soul into. So we played some of those, and we also played, we did like breweries and distilleries and wineries and pretty much every type of venue you could think of. We pretty much did on this tour.
Is it mostly just you and AJ out doing the shows, or have you ever bring a band with you out?
Yeah, we did a couple of bigger festivals this year, so we brought 2 or 3 other musicians with us for those. Rob Lampe, who's a guitarist I played with for a long time, he came on several of them. And then also from St. Louis, Ross Christopher he played violin and bass with us, but he's also a singer-songwriter in his own right, and he came to some of the bigger shows, bigger paycheck shows, where, you know, we knew we could afford to bring some other musicians with us.
And did you go do any shows overseas this time?
Not this time. We're thinking about 2016 returning to maybe England. We were there in 2013, and I'd like to do more in the United Kingdom, because I've done some in Italy, some in France, you know, a lot in Asia. But yeah, I'd like to do a lot more in the United Kingdom. So
yeah, you guys need to go back over there with this and promote this CD. I think you.
Yeah, I feel that way too.
I think it'd go over really big over there.
Yeah, thank you. I hope so.
So what's the best part of touring?
I would say the best part is probably the sense of adventure and the freedom. I mean, even though we definitely have schedules we have to meet and places we have to be, I feel like we feel like we're the agents of our own destiny. And even though the sitting in the car for hours and hours and hours a day is not fun, and it's kind of hard on your body and your mind, it's just always, you never know exactly what's going to happen. So I like that sense of adventure, and that every day is a new day. And that we're in control of it, basically. I love that.
Mm-hmm. And then what's the worst part of touring?
Probably the uncertainty, you know, of if we're going to get enough rest. I'm like, I get a lot of migraine headaches and, you know, issues like that. And so for me, it's tough to sort of balance my physical comfort and making sure that I'm actually going to be able to give the energy needed to sing and perform when I'm not sure where I'm going to be laying my head, you know?
Yeah. Is there anything you have to bring with you on tour to make you feel like I won't be able to do this? I mean, like, is it like a vocal thing you have to bring with you, or is there like a pillow you have to bring? I mean, is there an item that you feel like I've got to have this on tour with me, or I won't be able to do this?
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I can actually get it anywhere, but I sort of panic if I don't have Ricola. That's actually still the best cough drop I've ever found for my throat. Also a water bottle. We're just constantly sucking down the water.
Yeah, it's very important to stay hydrated. I mean,
yeah, and those sound really boring.
Truthfully, it is. I mean,
it absolutely is. And those sound really boring, but that's, you know, it's true. It kind of comes down to the basics and the basics of how you take care of yourself. And I remember opening for Jonathan Brooke. Do you know her?
I love her. Yes.
Yeah, she's amazing. And I asked her, I said, how do you, because at that time, I would find that I seemed to be losing my voice, even though I've been classically trained and studied opera and all this. And she said, it's water. She said, that's how I keep my voice. She said, I drink so much water. And I thought, that seems like a ridiculous piece of advice. How can that be? But then now that's what I'm telling people, because it really is true. You can be pretty fatigued, and if you drink enough water, you usually you're able to keep your voice, you know, unless you're ill or something like that. So
right. And even in the morning to wake up, drinking a glass of water, it helps. I mean, it kind of jumpstart your day.
It does. It does. It makes you more alert. I don't remember where I read it, but it was about driving at night and road fatigue. And some people said, you know, you might not need food and you might not need a, you know, 5-hour energy. You might just need some cold water. It's really helpful.
Yeah, for sure. And you were talking earlier, we were talking before we started the interview about you're going to be working on another video.
Yeah.
Which song are you doing a video for?
Well, we've kind of been torn about that. But what we're leaning towards right now is actually Lotta Love, the Neil Young cover. So Freight Train Love was the original thought because it is the title track. But Lotta Love is, I think, sort of a hidden gem in that record. And I think that Neil Young needs to hear it.
Is that one Nicolette Larson did?
Yeah, that's the one Larson covered. And I think we have this concept. I don't want to give away the concept for it yet, but we have a concept idea for the video. It's not just going to be, you know, us mimicking our instruments or lip syncing or anything. I think it's going to be pretty cool. So there's a storyline that we have an idea for. So we'll see if it takes shape, but that's our idea right now. So
awesome. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm reading his autobiography. Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
Waging Peace, something like that. It's really interesting because he kind of writes like it's like a flow of consciousness.
Okay.
And his writing is it's kind of a fun read because he goes like from one thing to another and he's just like thinking about things and he just writes about it.
Very cool. Yeah.
So you should read it.
Okay.
I think it's called Waging Heavy Peace. It's what it's called.
Okay.
The one thing I was really wondering too, and before we stop, I wanted to ask you this question: you're considered an indie artist. Do you aspire to be on a major label or to get past that label of indie artist?
You know, I really don't. I think I love pretty much everything that comes with that, except for, of course, I think it's harder and harder for indie artists to make a living in the digital age because so much music is traded and shared for free. And there's a lot of I think, especially maybe teenagers who don't, they've never grown up with the concept of like, holding an album in your hands and looking at the artwork and reading the lyrics and, you know, the things that I grew up with. And so I think that everything about independent is cool because you are your own boss. You own all of your own material, but you don't have all that publicity and monetary support behind you. So yeah, there are some trade-offs, but I definitely like being the owner of all my intellectual property. And I don't know that the majors are as great of a game for people as they used to be. You hear about major artists going bankrupt like Billy Joel and, you know, people that you think that should never happen, you know?
Yeah, no way.
No
way.
That's
ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. And so if that can happen to someone of that caliber, it's just kind of scary, you know, to think that your songs could be shelved or that you could not perform them again or, you know, something horrible like that. So this is good for now. We can sustain ourselves. I would like to have more money. I'd like to be able to have a savings account or a retirement, and maybe that one day will come. But, you know, I'm pretty happy with being an indie.
So have you tried selling your music to movies or TV?
Well, no. That is one aspect of, you know, being an independent artist that can be a little bit tougher. You're not automatically in touch with a team to help you do those sorts of things. And licensing is a huge, huge gaping hole in what I'd like to be doing. I do think that, you know, selling my songs for various purposes like film and TV is where I need to go, especially if I want to sustain a living as a songwriter. So yeah, that's kind of actually our goal for this year is to reach out and try to find a good agent to work with in that regard.
Mm-hmm. I think you'd be great doing that. Have you, this might be kind of a political slippery slope here to ask you about, but how do you feel about downloads and the price that they ask for downloads and the amount of money that an artist gets from a download?
I think that any form of art that has been able to be digitized is definitely losing something in the bargain. I think that, you know, this is just one example. So if you're at a live show and you're selling your music for, let's say, a full-length album is $15, people are balking at that. But I remember when CDs first came out, they cost $18 to $20 in a store, and the artist was only getting a fraction of that. So actually, the price of even physical music has gone down. The artist is still not getting the full amount of that if they have an independent label or whatever to pay back cost for producing the CD even. And so it's amazing to me that people have just forgotten what the price of music used to be in the market. And also the fraction of what we get for online distribution is really, really small. I'm grateful for the fact that it's out there and it's a little more accessible on a worldwide scale. But I would definitely say that for the actually making a living part of your music, it's harder and it's not quite fair if you want to say it in those terms, because writers and authors and musicians are the two areas in which the price put on the product is definitely not equitable with the blood, sweat, and tears, time and money and effort that went into making the product and the creativity and the talent that was required and all the years of schooling perhaps and or just practice and learning that the person put in. Anything that can be reproduced too many times. And that's why I wish that, you know, like if you make a single painting and you do visual art, you can set a very high price for what is considered unique. But to me, that's where the live music experience comes in, and that's getting lost a little bit too. People are no longer paying for the live music experience unless, you know, and it's just, they're just losing so much. The culture of that is just, it's really on the decline, and it's really tragic because that is where the unique experience comes in. And if nothing else, people should be willing to pay for that. But it might be a political slippery slope, but I think people need to realize that artists, it's not that they can't do other things. It's not that we are not bright enough, educated enough, or smart enough to do other things. It's that this is what we are called to do. Mm-hmm. And the reason that there used to be patrons of the arts was that those people with money said, okay, my life is made better and I am brought up to a higher level spiritually and emotionally and whatever you want to say because of these artists. So I am going to give them money to survive on so that they can create what I need to have a better life. Right. And now people just see it as, well, you've decided to be poor and do this as a hobby. No, actually, you know, some of us want to make a living at it and it should still be possible, but it depends on people recognizing the value of it. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. I think the internet a little bit has devalued it.
I think it's devalued it a lot. I'm one of these people. If I'm going to get music, I want to buy the CD. I'm going to go and purchase it on Amazon or through the artist's website or whatever. Right. I'm not going to go download it because I think that's, for one thing, that's cheating me as a listener because that quality is not nearly as good. And secondly, it's cheating the artist because they're going to see one penny of that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. And I just can't do it. I mean, I don't believe in downloads, personally.
Yeah. You know, so. And there are some that are better than others. Like iTunes pays much more than any of the other ones. And that's good because iTunes has a monopoly on it, right? So mm-hmm. that's at least good that you get more from an iTunes download than from other ones. But it's crazy. I have a couple of songs. We didn't even know this until AJ was doing some research and he said, do you know how many times some of your songs have been streamed on Spotify? And the numbers are like way huger than I ever would have guessed. Mm-hmm. And I don't see anything for that, you know? And so it's like, if I were on a major label and I were being tracked on radio, I would at least be getting royalties from that. But then there's even those royalty collection agencies right now that are kind of making it hard for the little guy too.
Yeah.
Because they'll penalize venues that still have live music, but it's like, why are they claiming that they need to collect royalties on me playing my own music? That's
right.
I should be able to play it for a fee or not for a fee whenever and anywhere I want to. So it's a very tangled web and it's I don't know. It's just difficult to know, you know, how it's going to shape out in the next 10 years or so.
Right. And how much of that money are you seeing from that fee that they're paying, that license they're paying? I mean,
Zero.
Yeah. I mean, if you were Billy Joel, you might see something.
Right.
But Hillary Scott's not going to see any of that money.
Exactly.
And you're probably doing more live shows a year than he is.
Exactly. And I'm losing some of those opportunities to play live shows for venues who say, oh, I'm scared to hire you because you're a member of, I won't say any organization names or whatever, but it's not benefiting me on either end then.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a real problem for independent artists.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to give me your opinion about that, because I'm always I'm always interested to see what artists think about it. And it's good to hear that you're passionate about it, too.
Thank you. Yeah, I sometimes get a little overly passionate. I probably scare people, but yeah.
Well, I mean, because I think that gives people a real insight of what independent artists go through. I mean, it's not, it's your life, it's your calling, and it's what you need to do as a human being to fulfill yourself. And it also fulfills us as people to hear you play and make music. And it's a lot to go through, you know, just to do that. And I know you supplement your income too by teaching. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that helps you a lot as well. I'm a teacher as well. I do guitar. Mm-hmm. I teach guitar, and that's how I'm making a living right now, you know. So
yeah, and it's really hard. And I have this amazing student base that's, I mean, they've been amazing this past year, because we've been on the road almost consistently since May, and we've had sparse lessons here and there, and they say, you know what though, we appreciate the fact that you're out there doing what you're teaching, and so you bring this experience back to our kids, you know, and share something different with them than if this were just happening in a private lesson room once a week for 45 minutes or whatever. So yeah, it's wonderful to be able to share music as a teacher as well. It's a different side of it, but I find it equally enriching.
Yeah, I do too. I love all my students. Well, Hillary, thanks again for talking to us. I want to tell everyone your website is hillaryscott.com. That's Hillary with one L. And you can pick up her music from that site, or you can go to CD Baby, iTunes, and Amazon also carry her music as well.
Yep.
You'll be putting out a new video in the next few months. And then you have other videos up on YouTube. Some are live performance. And then what was the other video that you did?
We did Flowers on Mars. That was an official video that we put out. Yeah, we'd love for people to check that out. It's kind of fun.
And that's on YouTube as well?
It is, yeah.
And you can also see that on a website.
Yes.
Go there and check out Hillary. It's hillaryscott.com. And of course, you can hear her on KC Cafe Radio. And we'd love for you to request her music and listen to more of Hillary Scott on KC Cafe Radio. Mm-hmm. So thanks again, Hillary. I'm sure we'll be seeing each other soon and talking soon. And
yeah, thank you so much, Kathy. I've really appreciated talking to you today. So it's been really fun.